A celebration of Christ the King Sunday seems especially appropriate this year. This celebration was added, as you may know, pretty late to our church year calendar, and it was in response to the crisis of leadership in the early 20th century. This celebration was instituted by Pope Pius IX in 1925. So think about what was going on in the world, particularly in Europe, in 1925. Mussolini had been dictator for 3 years. Stalin was coming to power in Russia. And Hitler's popularity in Germany was just beginning to take hold. And despite the rising to power of these dictators, Christ the King Sunday asserted that, nevertheless, Jesus Christ is Lord, and he shall reign forever and forever. The day stands, therefore, as a critique to every form of earthly power, and it stands as a sign of hope in the face of our current crises of leadership. You may have heard of René Girard. He was an historian, social philosopher, literary critic, who ended his distinguished career at Stanford University and died just a few years ago in 2015. Enormously influential. His key ideas developed from his examination of fundamental stories in literature. Think Shakespeare, think the Greek myths, think Oedipus in particular. And these, looking at these stories led him eventually back to the Bible, and then from there, as he examined the Bible, back to the Catholic faith of his youth. And at the risk of oversimplifying some complex ideas, he believed that human development from infancy is a series of learned behaviors, okay so far, and that comes about through imitating others, okay so far, but crucially imitating what others not just have, but what they desire. And he links the development of our identities, knowledge, and material well-being to our desire to have something that others possess, but also to have those things that others desire. He calls this mimetic desire. He says that it is the root of all human violence and conflict. If you and I both desire the same thing and we live in a world of scarcity, then we're going to have an issue because we both want it. What are we going to do? It's much easier for me if I get rid of you than I can have what you desire, and what I therefore also desire. But individuals and groups manage this inherent tendency to violence by the creation of a third party, by the creation of a scapegoat, is what Girard calls them, scapegoats who provide a kind of false sense of unity and well-being. So if you and I desire the same thing, we can manage the anxiety in a relationship if we talk about how dreadful this third person is. Then we can feel togetherness and overcome our anxiety. See how it works? There's much more to this, including the development and importance of religion in managing our tendencies to violence, but that's for another day. Girard, in 1972, in a book called Violence and Sacred, begins by discussing revenge, vengeance. He calls it an intolerable menace. Vengeance professes to be an act of reprisal, and every reprisal calls for another reprisal. It is an interminable, infinitely repetitive process. Every time it turns up in some part of the community, it threatens the whole social body, because there's no stopping retribution after retribution after retribution. The multiplication of reprisals, he says, instantaneously puts the very existence of society in jeopardy, and that is why it is so universally proscribed. Some of you came to the fabulous recent Global Missions gathering with a speaker from the school we support in South Sudan, Hope and Resurrection School, and among the many powerful stories that night, there was one that talks about the interruption of this cycle of violence and vengeance. Talked about a young woman who was in the school who was taught with war raging round about that war is not the way, that hatred is not the way, that vengeance is not the way. And in this school, they practiced that. And the teachers would interrupt conversations and make sure that people were thinking and talking towards peace. And there was a break in the school year, and this girl went home, and her father arrives at the school kind of befused and almost angry, saying, "What have you done to my daughter?" And he said, I was at the point when I sent her here that I wasn't ever going to come and pick her up. She was so difficult. She was so oppositional. She created tension in the family. She was never doing what she was asked. She was not respecting her mother. She was on and on and on. And now you send her home, and she's the peacemaker. She's interrupting us, telling us not to talk to each other that way. She's a remarkable child. And he said, how have you done this? How have you done this thing? So it can be an individual can interrupt this cycle. But Girard argues that the cycle of vengeance has been broken in many modern societies thanks to one institution above all, and that is the judicial system. The rule of law does not suppress vengeance, but it limits it to a single act of reprisal enacted importantly by a sovereign authority whose decision in one way or another, sometimes in our case by going all the way to the Supreme Court, by one way or another, this serves as the final word on vengeance, on reprisal, on punishment, on consequence. Now, it's not hard to see the development of a judicial system in the Torah expressed in the first five books of the Bible. And one example that springs to mind is the law of an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. And we first encounter this, first encounter of many is in Exodus 21. And it sounds to our ears, mostly if we don't think about it, as an encouragement to vengeance and violence. But in its time, it was really a limitation of the bounds of vengeance. It had the force of you may only take an eye for an eye. You may not go and slaughter someone's whole family because of some wrong that you perceived you have suffered. This might be lost on many today. And I'd like to quote a few words from our current president, who was front-runner for the Republican nomination in 2016, was asked in a radio interview for his favorite verse of the Bible that impacted his thinking or character. He's been asked this from time to time. But on this occasion, he kind of spluttered and went around, when we get in the Bible, I think many, and he goes on. And some people, and he says, look, an eye for an eye, you can almost say that. That's not a particularly nice thing, but you know, if you look at what's happening to our country, I mean, when you see what's going on with our country, how people are taking advantage of us, how they scoff at us, how they laugh at us, and they laugh in our face, and they're taking our jobs, they're taking our money, they're taking the health of our country, and we have to be firm and have to be very strong, and we can learn a lot from the Bible, that I can tell you. And that's a quote. What is an example of here is a classic human impulse to which every one of us is subject at some level. And that is to garner a kind of delicious sense of unity and purpose from having a common enemy. And that's especially true when we feel in some way that we've been wronged, when there's almost a level of vengeance coming out in this desire for unity. And it's the death of Jesus, about which we've heard again today, that just how wrong and destructive and violent is that impulse to false unity. This is the scapegoat mechanism that Girard talks about at work in the story of Jesus' trials and execution at the hands of the Roman and Jewish authorities, who colluded to keep the peace with each other during a festival when Jerusalem was crowded. They effectively overcame their anxieties and came together to create a third party, a scapegoat, someone whose bloodshed would settle their anxieties, not least in their uneasy relationship with each other. And so today we hear the prophet Jeremiah saying that the vengeance of God would be brought upon those who scattered God's own flock. You may remember elsewhere it said, God says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. But God's vengeance would be different. It would be the undoing of the wrongs, not the punishment of the wrongdoers. And so he talks to the people in exile and prophesies that vengeance would take the form of their being gathered and brought back into the fold, brought back to Israel and Judah from exile. And more than that, they would be fruitful and they would multiply. They were, in a sense, God's vengeance was going to become the worst nightmare of those who benefited from exile. But more than that, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. And so in our reading from Luke, we see that king. We see that king raised on his throne. an instrument of shameful death, where in spite of the torture and in spite of the mockery, he still dispenses a kind of justice to one of the criminals crucified with him under a sign filled with irony. This is the King of the Jews. Now, where does this leave us? Well, it leaves us with our own, recognizing our own tendencies to create scapegoats when we find ourselves with anxiety in our relationship for any reason. And we find that tendency unveiled for all to see. And it leaves us knowing that we can, and in fact must, learn to live differently by being transparent in our relationships with each other. To resist when we see others being made into scapegoats in order to create a kind of false unity, to challenge that when it happens. And there are so many examples at the moment, but we must resist, especially today, the narrative that we've heard of late that DACA recipients are now grown into hardened criminals and demand instead a coherent, compassionate, sensible immigration policy from our elected leaders. This scapegoating has got to stop. We must resist an eye for an eye type of thinking wherever we find it, and instead do all in our power to uphold the dignity of the judiciary and the rule of law, because in the end, every one of us is accountable to a greater king, a suffering servant of the people, of us, who opens for us the way of abundant life, not only showing us another way, but in a sense by becoming the way for us to claim and proclaim the promises of abundant life for everyone in the gospel. So in our customary time of silence for prayer, use it how you will, but perhaps think about what you've got coming up. What can you say or do around a dinner table? Thanksgiving can be more challenging for some families than for others, but what are the opportunities there to stand for what is right and resist what is wrong? Or perhaps at work, or wherever. How do we uphold the values of people who know ourselves subject to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, compassionately, knowing that judgment is God's, people who know that knowing that the power of death has been overcome, and therefore we can encourage and practice such absurd things as forgiveness and generosity and service to others in a world where many still resort first to violent mechanisms to manage relationships. Maybe ask for wisdom. In silence and in response to the gospel, let us pray.